This is Listening to the Dead.
Uncovering the secrets of forensics today.
I'm Linda LaPlante, novelist, producer, writer of 150 hours of TV and 33 crime novels. And truthfully, I don't think one could have been completed without the assistance of the police, especially my close friend Cass Sutherland.
Hi, I'm Cass Sutherland, former detective and CSI in the Metropolitan Police Force.
This is Episode 5, Digital Forensics.
Actually, making this episode has been a bit of an eye-opener for me, especially as digital forensics was sort of in its infancy, really, in the latter part of my service. And when it did arise, it really only involved pinging a mobile phone for a possible location and getting details of calls made and received. Of course, that's all changed now. Technology and digital forensics has advanced.
Yes, it certainly is. I didn't really include anything about this field in my books until the Anna Travis series and Above Suspicion on TV. But recently, I was in New York and was with the special narcotics prosecutor for the city of New York. And I had unbelievable access to the department where they were monitoring mobile phones, particularly for checking drug trafficking. So they made an arrest of a drug trafficker. They managed to get his mobile phone. At the same time, another section in New York had also arrested a drug trafficker. What they were doing by monitoring their phones was to find out who contacted who was dealing, who was buying, and they were getting so much information off a simple mobile phone, which, of course, now, when you're a writer, that really jumps your plot forward. Sometimes you don't want it to move that fast. You can find a body, and then as a writer, you're taking tremendous time to access who he is, who she is, where it was, what happened, who was the last person that viewed the body. But in reality, if you find that person's, that victim's mobile phone, you can access who was the last person they spoke to, who was the last person in the location where that phone could be pinged. And so as a writer, you have to learn how to move and understand the information that you're getting, because that can move a plot forward. But it also requires the writer to keep an energy level on all the other matter within the storyline.
That's interesting. I mean, from my day, we had one case which had involved a murder. And the guy said, no, I wasn't anywhere near there. And the phone pinging it actually did put him near there, but not sort of exactly there. But what was interesting, he said, I was just out walking that day. But when they looked at where he'd used the phone, he was being picked up on different masts, which meant when you looked at it, he was walking at about 40 miles an hour. So that kind of helped to destroy his story about how he was moving and really put him inside a vehicle.
Again, I think there is so much more we're looking at in TV series from America and documentaries from America about crime because of the vast expanse from county to county. Whereas in England, again, the writer's going to come up against it. You know, if he says, oh, I was in Manchester on the day of the murder, and you go, that's odd, because your phone has got you literally 5 miles from where the victim was living. And that area is also, unfortunately, been made aware of by a lot of criminals, which is why they use the throwaway phone. Yeah. They buy a phone, make a call, chuck the phone. So they can't be traced, they can't be pinged. But sometimes they think they're so clever, they've got a throwaway phone, but they've got the big mobile in their hand as well, not realising you've thrown away one evidence, but we're pinging you on your entire journey from when you did the murder to where you go home.
Well, we used to do it similarly. We'd look at when we could get the details of the calls made, and you'd find that even if they use a throwaway, they still phone mum, and you check all the numbers and the people who are phoned, and you'd say, "Oh, did anybody phone you?" "Oh, yeah, it was my son. He was phoning me about." So there are different ways of getting there. It just takes a bit longer sometimes, but I think with digital technology now, it is so important. It can actually help police, obviously, solve crimes get to a suspect quickly.
It absolutely can help solve a crime, but it's also, you catch the liar. You know, were you in a good marriage? Did you have a good marriage? Oh, yes, we were very happy and looking forward to the future. Then up on their mobile phone, there's a ping to Lisa, another ping to Lisa, and another ping, and a ping, and a ping, and a ping to Lisa. So who is Lisa? Well, that is somebody I work with. So are you having an affair? They've got them. And it's all there on their mobile, but that brain power that thinks I can lie my way out of it is, again, much more difficult when they've got that access to their private life.
Well, there's a lot of husbands and wives who automatically delete their messages, that's for sure.
But you can't delete anything.
That's right.
That's the other thing they don't and are not aware of. They can catch you out over and over again.
I mean, the thing is, I mean, a phone years ago was just a phone. You could make calls, you could see the number made or a message. Now it's so much more. I mean, I've known of a case where a lady was murdered and she'd put her phone on record. And she put it up on top of a shelf, and the murderer was caught by that. But the phone wasn't actually found on top of a cupboard, actually, until a few days later. And then when I'd actually heard it myself, and it's one of the most horrific things I think I've ever heard. But she knew that she might be attacked by him, and she set the phone to record, and that's what caught him.
Of course, you know, although we've been talking about the access you get from a mobile phone, particularly for a police inquiry, but that's just a very small part of the IT.
Certainly. It's a vast, vast area now. I mean, it's phones themselves are like computers, but there are computers, laptops, so many different handheld devices and applications that all need to be looked at and can help investigate the crime. But one person who's trying to do exactly that is Dr. Jan Coley, a digital forensics expert. And I recently spoke to her about her craft. I'm back in the office, ready to call Dr. Jan Coley, a digital forensics expert who's acted for both the defence and prosecution, with cases involving a large variety of serious charges, such as dark web drug dealing, blackmail, cyberbullying, rape, murder, and possession of indecent images. She has a PhD in digital forensics, data security and cybercrime, and is also a chartered engineer and certified computer examiner. That's one impressive CV. Let's give her a ring and find out more about this very modern and ever-evolving branch of forensics. Hi, Jan. I'm Cass. Thanks very much for giving us your time. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
When did digital crime become a forensic science and how did you get involved in it?
So historically, really, digital forensics has kind of grown and grown and grown. Up until about the 1990s, we always used to call it computer forensics rather than digital forensics. And it wasn't really until after the 1990s, around the time I started to come into it, really, in the early 2000s, that it started to become a bit of a scientific or more of a scientific discipline. There weren't kind of rules to be followed. And then in 1998, the Association of Chief Police Officers, which goes by the acronym ACPO, produced the first version of its Good Practice Guide for Digital Evidence, which was really a guide for officers in the field and the rest of us, those of us in digital forensics, as a guide to say, look, if there's evidence, you have to gather it in this way. It has to be handled in that way. And that is good practice. And that's where when the process started to get, if you like, more like a science than, look, here's an interesting bit of info. Let's have a quick look at that.
Over this series, I've spoken to a number of different scientists who are all experts in their fields and their disciplines. But digital crime must be one of the most constantly evolving crimes within the forensic world.
Yeah, I mean that's one of the things with the field. Years ago, you know, when we all started with this, you could be quite expert at virtually every aspect of it. Now it's just so wide and broad and deep that you can't call yourself expert in all the fields because there's too much information, there's too much stuff. You've got so many types of devices now. It's not just a mobile phone. A mobile phone is now a miniature computer, which is not what it used to be before. But then you've got all your personal assistants at home, for instance, your Echo or your, you know, you've even got Fitbits, you've got your watches, you know, your digital watches, and all these things gather information. All these things have data on them. It's a question of how much data and whether it's useful or not, whether you can even get at it. But yes, I mean, it's overwhelming now. Information everywhere, absolutely overwhelming.
So if the police, say, for example, are dealing with a murder, they've got the victim's phone and they give it to you, what would you be looking for?
Usually it'll be down to phone calls or messages. So when you get the mobile phone, if you get the mobile phone, even that's changed now. Quite often all you get is the download that the police have already made and you don't get access to the whole phone at all, something which I object to because you can't make a proper assessment. But let's say you have the mobile phone. In the first place, you've got to keep it forensically sound. So it must not be able to contact any kind of network, whether wireless or a cellular network. That's so that the evidence doesn't change. Everybody understands with what we call wet forensics, such as blood, and, you know, bodily fluids and so forth. Everybody knows because they've seen enough Miss Marple series that if there's a body on the floor with a knife in the back and there's a trail of blood, you don't step in the blood, you don't move the knife, you don't touch the body. With computers and mobile phones, the danger is always that people don't think like that. They go, oh, look, you know, tappy, tappy, nosy, nosy, or flicky, flicky on the phone. And they start having a little, because they can't help themselves, and they start having a look. And by then, you've damaged the evidence. You've altered it. You may have what I call trodden on it. So you might have actually accidentally overwritten something. You might have accidentally deleted something. You have fundamentally changed that evidence. That evidence now should not be admissible. So with a mobile phone in particular, anything that's internet connected or cellular connected, the first step is to keep it completely off the network so that none of the data on that phone can possibly change. And then usually from that point, you make an assessment, you make evidential photographs, you take notes, the colour of it, what state it's in, what's on the screen. So all the features that you note down, and then you connect it to your forensic software, and then you take a download. When the download's complete, you've got X amount of data, which you then analyse, depending upon the nature of the case. So if they've said, we just want the messages, you just look at the messages. And because there'll be hundreds of them, you usually narrow it down to certain dates. Let's say the charges or the suspect is supposed to have been messaging somebody on this and this day or between these months or between these weeks. Then you narrow it down to that, because otherwise you'd be there forever.
Are there ever any cases where you actually get called to the crime scene, say in respect of a computer and unplugging it? Because I'm led to believe that some cyber criminals and that have set computers or laptops up so that if they're on and you turn it off, it can erase all the information on it.
Oh yes, if they've left it running, you've got to be very, very careful indeed. That's one of the things you have to do, a live forensic. One of the things you have to do, if there's a computer running when you arrive at the scene, you take a photograph of what's on the screen because it's touch and go how long that's going to remain. And yes, I mean, the live analysis is a very sensitive exercise because you're always at the mercy of perhaps somebody zapping the information from afar or having some kind of a bit of malware running in the background that's going to fuberize everything. You know, so it's sort of like you stuff your hands in your mouth, bite them very hard, eat a Valium sandwich and hope for the best.
Do you find that obviously criminals become more forensically aware, I should imagine, especially in the digital world, because...
Yeah, they do, yeah.
And they think they can sort of cover their tracks by deleting the history and everything, but... Are you able to still, you know, there's something in there
yeah.
you can find?
Yes, 9 out of 10. I mean, to answer that question properly, it's going to sound awful, but you can always tell a suspect that's actually been to jail before. Because, you know, when you look at a computer, the way that I do investigations, I'm not saying everybody does it this way. I do a holistic overview. I want to know what I call my victim, right? He or she is not my victim, but it's sort of a mindset, you know.
Yeah,
you
go, yeah.
Okay, let's see what you're all about, sunshine. So you have a little look at their photographs. You have a little look at their web browsing, little look at their documents. You have a little look at their email. All of that gives you an overview of what type of person this is, how educated they are, how they express themselves, how they feel about themselves in the real world, what impression they like to give the exterior world, which will be a completely different thing to how they feel about themselves. Their photographs will tell you what's dear to their hearts or the sorts of things that they're interested in. All the time you're doing that, you're building a profile. You're profiling the person. And whilst I'm profiling, I can usually tell how smug or otherwise somebody is at the technology. I can always tell how smart they are. But in particular, if you go to certain areas of the operating system, there are certain areas that are always populated. There are certain areas of the operating system that, as the machine's working, there can't not be any information in there, and it certainly won't all be zeros. So if you come up with one of those places and it's all zeros, you just know that somebody's used something to blat that information. And as soon as you see those zeros, you go, OK, now I'm going to start looking for evidence wiping software.
I wonder, though, from an experience of my own, I don't know if false positives would be the right word. Some years back, early 2000s, I was doing some research work. So I was looking at stuff to do with torture and tying people up so it didn't show physical marks.
Yeah.
And suddenly I'd have come up pornographic websites about bondage and things like that. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm in trouble here. I mean, are there cases like that where the police are sort of convinced because that person's looked at that site, but that might not necessarily be the case?
Yes. I mean, there is always, if you're browsing a shed load of porn, there'll be all stuff down the side, like adverts and things, you know, little boxes all down the sides, little videos running. A lot of these websites have got hundreds of photographs on them. So you've seen the screen that's in front of your face, but you don't know what's below the level of your monitor. Now, all of those pictures are in your temporary internet folder. So all of those pictures are now on your computer. They're not saved in a folder called My Dodgy Porn, but believe me, I've seen a few folders with funny names. You couldn't make it up. So some people are just sort of don't have any clue about that kind of thing. But it's not in a special folder, but it's in a hidden folder on the computer that, if you're not very computer savvy, you don't know it's there. But it's just there as part of the operating system. But now there is an image. There are probably quite a few images kept in that folder. And if the police arrive, kick down your door and take your computers away, that's in your possession. That has been in your possession, and they're going to charge you with that, even though that you might not physically have seen it. You may not even have looked at it. It might have been below what was on your screen. But there's all sorts of reasons. There's a huge propensity for nasty stuff to arrive up on your computer that you didn't know and you didn't ask for.
Have you ever had any cases kind of like in that respect of, say, a begrudged partner or somebody who's disgruntled with somebody who has access to their PC or their laptop, and while they're in the living room, they download something? Because I can imagine that if it's your PC, it would be very hard for somebody to say, I didn't do that, unless they could prove they were elsewhere at the exact time that was downloaded.
Well, you see, the trouble is where people share logon details, and that will be families, in families people do it, friends people do it, younger people quite often, it's meant to be the first marker of being in love with somebody. They share their ruddy passwords. It just makes me want to pull my hair out, frankly. Or if you use stupid passwords like my cat's name 123, password 123, things that somebody else can guess. You can't prove your hands weren't on the keyboard. It's jolly hard. I can't prove your hands weren't on the keyboard. On the other hand, you can't prove whose hands actually were on the keyboard. And I have some cases where a disgruntled partner has put horrible stuff on somebody's computer because they want to get the person out of the house. It seems to be very strongly gendered in a certain direction. Hell hath no fury direction.
What about with cybercrime now? And a lot of the, you know, where the elderly are ripped off or people are ripped off via these emails that they think they've got to sign in or give their details.
Yeah.
A lot of it, you know, it travels around the world. It's hard to trace. Are you finding now within different countries there's better liaison with them to try and combat this type of crime, or is it something you think that we'll never be able to resolve?
Well, the trouble with nasties that come in on emails, it's so easy to spoof an email address. But the trouble is, not only can you spoof an email address, you can spoof an IP address. So how do I explain this easily? So that would look like your location at the time that you sent the email. You can make that look like it's anywhere in the world. For instance, I could sit here right now and pretend I was in Canada or something and then do a web search, and it looks like my IP address, that is to say the place where I'm located, is somewhere over there rather than, you know, sitting here somewhere in the UK. So that's one of the problems that you've got is simply tracing back where that might have emanated from. There's multiple hurdles. Not only would you spoof, if you were going to send a nasty, you wouldn't just spoof your IP once. You'd spoof it multiple times. You'd send it over as many servers as you could. If you were a criminal, you'd be doing that, sending it through servers in countries that don't play ball with Interpol, for instance.
Obviously, not everybody's aware, but there is a thing called cell site analysis, which enables you to track people through their mobile phones. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Cell site is one of my bugbears, actually. It's something that annoys me, the way that evidence is produced in court to do with cell site, as though it's absolute proof positive that a certain party was standing right outside 49 The Larches at that precise time of day on the day in question. And there's lots of reasons why that's horribly wrong. What cell site analysis can do, and cell site is to do with the cellular masts that your phone is actually touching. So all the time you're walking down the street, all the time your phone is actually on, it is touching various masts. One of the things is that this system is designed so that the phone connects to the strongest link with a tower or base station that offers the best signal. But as I often say in court, just to lighten up the proceedings, because it's usually very serious, it's a promiscuous connection. In other words, it's the strongest link. It might not be the nearest link. And it will just go, it might do it for a couple of seconds, and then it'll choose another one, then it'll choose another one. And it can change literally second for second, especially if you're at a place like London, a big city where there's lots and lots and lots of cell towers. Some of them, they're not even towers. Some of them are little micro pica ones that are, you know, on shopping centres and things of that nature. And all the time your phones, because they want to keep you connected as you're walking down the street having a conversation with your friend, it'll just jump about and pick the best signal that it can get. So that's one reason why it's very difficult to do. Also, you've got the extent of a cell signal. Now, out in the countryside, let's say you're in Norfolk, where it's really, really flat or something, a signal from a cell can go a really, really long way, potentially. It has the potential to go as much as 22 miles from the serving tower. But in suburban areas, they're usually spaced about 1 to 2 miles apart, and they can be as little as a quarter of a mile or a half a mile apart. But even so, a quarter of a mile or half a mile, again, in a big city,
it's a vast...
It's a long way. Yeah. And you might have been in the vicinity. Doesn't prove. I hate the word prove. When I see the word prove in an expert report, I go, right, I've got you now, because that doesn't prove anything. It suggests, or it strongly suggests, that the person was in that neighbourhood or in or around that location at that time. It's a good indicator,
yeah.
Not the whole story.
People have this perception that your field of work is sort of men that do it. Are there many women who actually do your kind of work?
Not a lot is the answer. It's it's getting better. I see more girls coming, girls and women coming through. And it used to be the case that it was a very male dominant. It still is a very male dominated field. I think because in the past you could only really get the skill set if you were police or military. And really, I was one of the first people to take a university course. There weren't that many on offer. But yes, I mean, it was for years, it's been the case that I turn up at X or Y conference and it's the same 250 blokes and me. Yeah, I like that kind of conference personally. But women are coming through. They're filtering through now. And there's quite a lot of police, you know, women in the police that you come across. But I'm beginning to see some more private practitioners, which can only be a good thing.
Well, hopefully, and I think it will undoubtedly, when the female listeners hear you speak and tell us about your work and how important it is in criminal investigation, that it will encourage more ladies to come on board and take up your kind of work.
Well, I wish they would, because I know this is a sweeping generalisation, but women tend to be rather good on detail. And anyway, why shouldn't a woman be able to do it? Clearly a woman can do it. In fact, the two genders, I think, bring a different perspective to it, a different approach, which again can only help an investigation, and so that can only be good. So I'd say to the women out there listening, go for it, girls. You know,
Jan.
Yeah.
Very many thanks for today. It's been really interesting and quite an eye opener for me as well, because as I say, but when I retired, digital crime was still kind of like taking off, and I've learned a lot more than I could ever imagine today, and I'm sure our listeners have. So thank you once again.
Yeah, you're very, very welcome. Nice speaking to you. Thanks a lot.
Cheers.
Bye.
Wow, that is really interesting. I've always wondered about the accuracy of cell site analysis, and it was fascinating to hear Jan confirm that it is open to misinterpretation. It's another area that is often used incorrectly in books and films, of course. And I remember watching a true life crime show, because I, as a writer of crime, I do have to keep ahead of everything that's going, because there's nothing worse than coming up with a novel about a crime and you open it and another writer has already written it and it's on TV. So you do have to keep abreast of everything that's going. And what was astonishing to me was how many times when the police have removed the computer belonging to the suspect and only to find that they have been on the internet trying to fathom out how long it takes before a body gets rigor mortis, how long it would take to cut up a body and freeze it. And you think, the stupidity, but it happens over and over again.
Exactly, and especially, obviously, as was alluded to, with terrorism, you know, because they post out there how to make bombs and how to go about detonating them, timers and all those sorts of things. And, of course, as people think, you know, if I delete it, that's the end of it. But it's not, because the information is still there and the experts can retrieve it.
But there is also another area that absolutely fascinates me, and that is the lists. I know numerous cases of a suspect, and they have uncovered in a notebook, left by their telephone, a list, a shopping list, rope, hatchet, bleach, absolutely incriminating themselves. Now they also find these lists on their computers as well. But the notes, I don't know exactly how many cases have actually been solved by somebody's list, but it is another, the logic behind, and that is a murder, that is a premeditated, cold-blooded murder, rather than a murder that occurs in the heat of the moment.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, actually, thinking about it. I mean, I use Alexa for my shopping. There's another bit of digital technology that could hold a wealth of information, even though you can find some of it. If there's other stuff that's kind of like in the cloud, it's getting access into the cloud. Well, there's companies now who are, and police forces who are recruiting people who were criminal fraudsters or hackers, predominantly youngsters, because their knowledge is so great, they are able to help them in the fight against digital crime.
In the old days, investigators, detectives, when they went into a suspect's home, would be able to say, well, I think this guy has spent a long time in prison. And they go, how do you know? Well, the way he's put his cup face down on the saucer. They do that in prison. So that old time, you know, looking at their environment of where the suspect lives. But nowadays, you go into prison. Often they emerge from prison with more skills than when they went in. So some of them go into prison never having been near a computer, never having had a laptop, anything, and they come out very savvy.
That's true, yeah. They learn from each other. But not only about computers, about all kinds of forensics and new innovations and that. But a lot of them still make mistakes, thankfully.
On their computer.
Well, that's it for this episode.
Next week, we'll be back with pathology.
I remember upsetting a lot of people in B&Q one day when I had an odd injury and I really wasn't sure what the implement was that had caused it. And as I was about to try and buy some shelves for my garage, I looked up at the masonry hammers and went, that's what killed him. Which gave people a bit of a shock, really.
Listening to the Dead is made in collaboration with Bonnier Books. Our producer is Chris Attaway. You can subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening now, and a new episode will pop up in your feed every week. Until then, thanks for listening, and don't share your passwords.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Listening to the Dead. My new novel, Buried, is out April 2nd, 2020, in hardback, ebook, and audiobook.